football on off the ball.
Once the fallibility centre sets in, once age starts to catch up with him, once Stephen Hendry's there, Steve Davis rolling back the years is one of the great things in snooker. Just because he was old and, as you know, to use John's phrase, had exposed his feet of clay.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Off the Ball Breakfast.
With Viagra Connect 50mg film-coated tablets. Contains sildenafil for adult men with erectile dysfunction. Maximum dosage 150mg tablet per day. Always read the label. Buy online at viagraconnect.ie. Subject to suitability following pharmacist consultation.
All right, welcome to a very special episode of You Had to Be There. Gerard, I think it's fair to say, as time has evolved, it's not strictly sports people per se that do this.
Oh, no. Not even supposed to be at all.
No.
Glad.
Well, maybe you are a sports person. It's one of your many talents.
Introducing a man here who has his own name in the film he just wrote and directed.
Correct.
That's a worldwide hit, top five in the world. It's Lee Cronin of Lee Cronin's The Mummy.
How are you doing?
Very well, yourself?
Yeah, good, good. Lovely to be here.
Some time to be Lee Cronin right now.
Apparently so, yeah. My producer likes slagging me all the time. I'll sit down and go, that's Lee Cronin's chair. I'm like, I get the point.
Why? What was the decision behind titling the movie as Lee Cronin's The Mummy?
It was to really differentiate it, because people have a baked-in idea of what a mummy movie might be or where it comes from. So I'm working with this producer called Jason Blum, who's like the most successful independent producer in the US of the last 20 years. Everything from loads of horror movies people would know, but also produced like Whiplash and, well, Get Out being a horror movie and Paranormal Activity. So he's a smarter man than me, and it was his kind of idea. When he read the script, he knew what my identity was in terms of how I make movies. So he said, look, let's do this and really kind of differentiate it. So it was, I didn't jump on it right away. It's like very Irish. Give me the weekend to think about it. Have a pint with a friend and check, is it actually a good idea or not? But kind of rolled with
it. I was saying that, yeah, because if you just did a survey of Irish people, we'd be like, oh, that's pure notions.
Exactly. But luckily I know the right ones.
Because it's a hell of a production team, like you mentioned behind you, because it's Jason Wan, Jason Blum.
Yeah.
And for people who don't know, like, these guys are pretty much given carte blanche to do what they like in this field because their track record is so supreme.
Exactly. And then they passed that along to me, so I was able to just go to town. We made the movie here in Ireland, which was great. So amazing team of people. And the majority of it was shot here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. So, and that's a huge part of reason for you as well as doing that, because I know you're massively into promoting the movie industry in Ireland as well.
And yeah, like, enormously.
It's a great time for the Irish film industry at the moment, but you still need people like yourself pushing it.
Yeah. And it's like, it's been growing for years. I think there's a lot of like big movies that come in, crews got really, really experienced. And then there's filmmakers such as myself that are coming through, but we're making movies that are commercially focused and kind of playing outside our borders, which is great. So it's a real kick. So my last movie, I shot it in New Zealand. I was there for 8 months. Whereas this one, I was 20 minutes from home, which was it was nice.
You're really from Skerries?
Skerries originally. Yeah.
So this stars Jack Rayner.
Yeah.
Irish man himself.
Indeed.
Great actor.
Indeed, yeah.
So I can't do horror, Lee Cronin. I can't sit through it. It terrifies me to my core. I don't know what that is. I've never looked into it too deeply.
It's part of the Irish psyche. Can you
frankly,
do it?
I don't want to look.
Well, I could, and then I had kids, and ever since then...
Do watch this movie, because it's... My movies are often lessons in parenting, even though I don't have children myself. But it's funny. I was just this morning texting with a writing friend of mine, an Irish guy who lives in Spain, and he keeps sending me posters from the subway in Madrid. And I was saying, we actually ended up, we were number one on Friday night in Spain. We ended up number two movie in Spain. And I was going, that wouldn't happen in Ireland with a horror movie, but the Spanish love their brutal, kind of crazy, outlandish horror. And so in Ireland, maybe a little bit less so.
Give us your pop psychology. Why is that?
I don't know. It must be something to do with, I don't know, something old and historical that had a grip on the entire nation. I can't put a label on it, though.
But we loved our horrific stories, like the Shanachie would be traveling around telling you about something just over the bend that's terrible. Like, we liked being terrorized.
But this thing, nation of storytellers, and everyone knows a ghost story, right?
That's right.
Everybody has that. But like, genuinely, if I stopped 100 people on the street and go, they'd go, I can't do horror movies.
See, I didn't realize that it was so widespread within Ireland. Mm-hmm. I thought I was in a minority.
97% of taxi drivers can't watch horror movies, I discovered.
Our producer, Dara, has just said in my ear there that Halloween, of course, comes from here. Like, there's the ghost Samhain. I would love, like you just said. And I suppose this is not related. Maybe it's a cousin of it, is that we're great at a funeral.
We are, and there's a if you like a funeral, there's a seriously epic funeral scene in this movie. There's a wake,
which is that very close to home. The inspiration,
yeah,
from that,
yeah, yeah. I kind of experienced the first kind of big loss in my life,
yeah,
a few years ago as I was kind of about to start writing this movie. And again, in Ireland, we love a wake, but it's still, on the one hand, there's the whiskey and the pints and the singing and all that stuff. But when you step back, it's also a pretty harrowing time. Someone you love in a box in a room for a couple of days,
yeah, at home.
So at home. And so for me, being a writer, I tend to try and find a home for these thoughts that I have about it. But I thought, if I'm going to put a wake in a movie, I'm going to make it the worst wake you could ever imagine being at. So what starts out as something that, you know, has the old women chatting over the edge of the coffin about how she looks and what she's wearing descends into supernatural madness by the end.
Can we get to a position here before we talk about Lee Cronin's The Mummy first? Is how did you get yourself into a position to have your name in the title, to have this production crew around you? How did you get to that level in your career?
Yeah, just it is a slow road, definitely. Like I said in the past, there's no business like slow business. It's a real grind. And essentially, it's just about building a team of people that you trust, like locally. So like I met my producer, John Kevill. We were making corporate films together. And that was in around 2007, and then we started to make short films together, and we built from there, and we made an independent movie in Ireland called The Hole in the Ground, which came out in 2019, and it premiered at Sundance. And it's kind of what you do with the opportunities, essentially, where you go with that. And then that got me on board to write and direct Evil Dead Rise, which came out in 2023, and was a bit of a sleeper hit and made a lot of people a lot of money. Not me, because it was my first Hollywood movie.
But that opened a huge amount of doors for you.
A lot of doors, definitely. And then kind of led to this. I could have done a sequel to Evil Dead, but I wanted to do something a little bit different.
Your short Ghost Train is on Disney Plus, if anybody wants to watch
indeed.
It at the moment.
Yeah, yeah, it is on Disney Plus.
There's a level of proficiency in filmmaking at that stage already that's like very high. And I presume maybe you look back on it now and go, oh.
It's not bad. That was not a low budget short, because sometimes when you think about short films, like we made our first one, which was called Through the Night. And it was about two people in a room, a couple caught in a supernatural situation. And we made that for about $2,000 or $3,000 at the time.
You can see some money is
and then, yeah, and then we got $15,000 for the next short. But then Ghost Train, we ended up having, I think it was about $60,000, which is a lot of money for a short. Now that doesn't, you can waste $60,000. But again, the family that I've built around me and the people I work with, that's a really big part of filmmaking for me.
So the proficiency at that point, where did that come from?
I guess my education was just watching a lot of stuff and very detail focused as well, very detail oriented in terms of how I approach stuff and how I plan it. I think like a lot of the time in the writing and the prep is where you actually have, like, you know, like prepping for a match, you know what I mean? But it's like, I draw a lot of comparison between filmmaking and sport all the time in terms of how you perform, how you prepare yourself for the big day. If you're shooting a movie, it's like your season, you know what I mean? Like so preparation is absolutely everything, really.
The Scorsese documentary at the moment that's out, when he was a kid, he was like doing frame by frame pictures. Are you at that level?
It kind of depends. I'm terrible at drawing. Like, my stick men are, they don't even look human, to be completely honest. So I'd work with storyboard artists quite frequently, and I've got, actually, a guy from Scary's where I came from worked on my movies. But sometimes they're used to be prepared for something.
And then
you kind of throw it away a little bit. But this last movie we made, my director of photography, a guy called Dave Garbutt, he's from New Zealand, married to a woman from Ranelagh, funnily enough. Didn't know that when I first worked with him in New Zealand. But we didn't use a shot list this entire movie, but we were really prepared in our minds, and we knew the operating principle of every scene and every moment and everything we wanted to achieve.
You can do that when you hit a kind of peak, in a way.
Yeah, you do get a bit of control of
your talents. I mean, as opposed to
And you don't always get it right. I'm still. I've so much to learn. I said, when you make a movie, it's like a quadruple master's degree in something you didn't quite know yet. Like, it really, every job I've done, there's just something new.
I know you have aspirations, I'd say, beyond comprehension. But at the same time, how do you kind of calm your ego? Because if Evil Dead Rise made $150 million box office for Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
Warner Brothers is going to love you for that.
They do. I'm in business with them.
Yeah. And then your movie now is in the top five in the world.
Yeah.
And so, like, I was really taken there. I know you were joking, but like, there's no business like slow business is a fantastic lesson for people.
Yeah. I think genuinely you have to take some pain. And if you take that pain, I think, and you drink your medicine along the way. What I mean by that is, I don't know, 8-9 years ago, I was living on $1,000 a month. I used to direct TV commercials, but they were getting in the way of me actually following the dream and making movies. So I said, you know what, I'm going to have to go and be broke to do this. And the once I stopped and the partnerships grew with other people and all of my focus and time could be specifically on following the dream. But that took 2 or 3 years as well, you know, to kind of get there. So it was like literally I was only talking to someone, who was I talking about the other day? Like genuinely putting a fiver or a tenner in the car, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, just kind of keep trucking.
That was one of the questions I had for you coming in today. Was like, how did you live as you were starting off? Because I believe you worked on Extravision.
I did back in the day in Scaries. Yeah, yeah. So when I was in film school. Now, this is back even further.
Yeah, yeah.
But I worked in Extravision in Scaries, and that was kind of, I'd work there 5 nights a week. So like 3 days a week when I was in film school, I'd come back. I commuted from Scaries to Baker's Corner in Dunleary. Train, dart, and bus, the holy trinity of Irish public transport. All of which never, if you missed one thing by a minute, you're like, yeah, I'm running out 4 hours late.
Yourself and Quentin Tarantino, so similar start.
Yeah, yeah. He was a video store.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right.
He's done a bit better than me so far, you know, still can
reach. The man is young, yeah.
I have a question for you from a listener, actually.
Okay.
Sent in ahead. Paul Moore, who I believe you know. Worked with him at Extravision.
No way.
Yeah, he's asked if you hated doing the 2 day late call list.
The 2 day, that actually rings a bell. So that was like, yeah, there was a printout you'd have to do on like old telex paper. Because the machine you worked on, or the computer that you worked on, you know, even though this was a while ago, it felt about 15 years older than that as well. There was a lot of weird manual inputs.
Pre-Windows.
Yeah, yeah, it was. It was green screen,
whatever it was. Yeah, I remember those.
But I actually really loved that job. I really, really loved that job. It was really fun. I used to have, there's a buddy of mine, best mate, who I went to film school with. You give him a shout out, a guy called Al Byrne. Unfortunately, he passed away a couple of years ago. And he lived in, I'm blanking now. He lived out in Kildare and he worked in a Chartbusters out that direction. And we would be on the same shifts. So we'd go to film school, hang out all day and be nerds. He'd be over there. I'd be down in Scaries. We'd sync up movies that we'd watch and just talk about movies the entire time. And then inevitably, you'd get that person that would come in and be roaming around all night trying to pick something. They'd look up at the TV and, you know, the little TVs, and they'd go, what's that? And you'd be like, could be something odd, I don't know. Man on the Moon with Jim Carrey. I'll take that. And you're like, oh no, that's my own copy. I'm halfway through watching the thing. You know what I mean?
A lot of people listening, watching here today won't realise, like, returning a video to Extravision or Chartbusters, having to rewind it.
Please Rewind Tape would be on the strip. Or the thing as a kid, when I was really young, would be something new would come out and they might have got in, say, 15 copies of it and be really popular.
Yeah.
You'd be hanging around on a Saturday night waiting for the clunk, and you'd be annoying the person behind the counter going, is that Gladiator? You know what I mean? Like, it would just be, I'm still a big physical media person. Like, I still buy and still own all my VHS from childhood and proper nerd.
Why the genre? And it seems to have been kind of early enough that you decided that you wanted to make these movies.
The entertainment factor, and my learning of that came from watching my siblings be scared. So there's a nine, they get fucking sick of me talking, but there's a 9-year gap to my sister. And then my big brother's one is, oh my God.
He's 14 years old.
Yeah, one is 14. Then there's kind of one in between. There's three of them anyway. And essentially they're another generation to me. So I was watching horror movies I shouldn't have seen at a really young age, but I was also scared watching them. So I'd be like this, watching them react.
Okay.
And I started, it just was like the circus to me. I was like, this is how you can actually entertain people.
You watched The Shining in two parts.
Yes, correct.
So the first part, you thought, this is fine.
It was grand.
Have a bit of dinner.
Yeah.
Came back, part two.
Part two.
Scared for life, but also inspired.
Had no idea why I was scared. That's the thing. It was the first time, like, complete confusion. Like, because The Shining is obviously quite a psychological horror movie. It's not obvious. You've got the hag in room 237, but it's not packed full of these things. But it was the tone and the music and the sound that really, really got to me. It scared the crap out of me when I was younger.
Did you get offered other genres after the success of Evil Dead Rise?
I think along the way I've flirted with other things. I'm interested in, you know, genre cinema in terms of whether it be sci-fi, mystery, thriller, really good detective story, good war story. Yeah. You know what I mean? Those type of things, they all interest me because they're quite spectacle driven in terms of their technique and all that sort of stuff. But I'm trying to think if I've been offered anything odd. Sounds like you know the answer to this and I don't.
I don't actually.
I thought you were going to pull up a rom-com there.
I do know, well, rom-com's not quite the same, but it is a buddy com, I suppose. One of your favourite films is Planes, Trains, Automobiles.
Correct. I love big John Hughes fan. And again, they were sort of movies my siblings would have been watching when I was younger. But Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, although set at Thanksgiving, is my favourite Christmas movie.
Oh yeah.
I'll always watch it at Christmas time.
Yeah, yeah.
The first ever screenplay I wrote, like a feature-length screenplay, was a weird horror. But the second thing I wrote was a romantic comedy, which I sold when I was about 23. Never got made, but it was a romantic comedy.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know that scene in the station in Planes, Trains, Automobiles when John Candy's character reveals mm-hmm. his actual life to Steve Martin?
Yeah.
You know that was much longer originally.
It was, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a big monologue, but the test audience laughed at it rather than sympathise, so they dropped it. And Steve Martin laments that because he said he was crying.
And now,
in the scene,
it does make you cry, though. It makes me cry anyway, the end of that movie. I haven't been home in years, that line.
The way it's left, because it is so short, means you have to fill in the rest with your imagination about, geez, just how bad is this guy's life?
Yeah.
It is incredible, like.
And John Candy as well, like, it's such a shame.
I know.
Have you watched the documentary?
I did.
Good.
You just lament the loss so much.
You should do a double head if you watch the John Candy doc and the Chevy Chase doc back to back.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Two very different personalities.
Well, you have a double header that means a lot to you, is Terminator 2 and The Commitments.
Correct. Yeah, back to my big brother, because I've been 14 years older. He was gone. He was away to college and he was like 18, straight out of school. He left home at that age. So we'd communicate a lot through movies and through like cool stuff, you know, whether it be video games or whatever. And he'd buy movies and then he'd copy them for me. And I'm not an advocate of piracy at all.
I'd imagine.
But it's not good for the business. But I don't think anyone back in the day didn't have a VHS. At least they bought it in the first place.
Yeah.
That's the thing. At least it was bought.
Yeah.
But he made me a long play VHS tape of Terminator 2 and The Commitment. So those movies, as different as they are completely one the same thing to me in terms of, you know, like sometimes you connect songs.
Mm.
Think of one song, it might remind you of something else. These two movies, I'd watch them on a loop. So, yeah, Terminator 2 was first, followed by The Commitments.
Why? How did you end up with horror? Because I think you seem to be a jovial guy by nature. You love Planes, Trains, Automobiles.
Yeah.
The Commitments is one of the most fun, enjoyable
movies
I've ever seen.
My favourite Irish movie.
I think there's a homage in the Mummy, isn't it?
There was a scene we cut out. That had a little tip of the cap to that scene in The Commitments where they've spelt the word heroin wrong at their first gig. So this story in The Mummy, it's about a little girl. She goes missing. She's got a little sister that wasn't born when she was kidnapped. And the little sister's excited. She's returned. She's made a sign, but she spelled her name wrong. But for pacing reasons, it hit the cutting room floor.
And so why make this movie that has been described everywhere as one of the goriest movies you'll ever see, which horror movie fans are actually going to adore?
Yeah. I didn't realise quite how disturbing it was. And that's what happens when you make horror stuff. But it was really interesting because we're just through opening weekend with the film.
Yeah.
And fans of genre have just embraced it so wholeheartedly. It's really, really humbling. And I did have that with the last movie, but this one's been different because it's really challenged people because it does blend. There's mystery. There's a family drama at the centre of it. There's heartbreak. It is a story about grief. And then it's got some really, really intense kind of horror moments. But for me, again, it's a really great way of entertaining people. It's also, it does allow you to sometimes look into the darkness and look a little bit deeper into the things that scare you. And I think you say a lot of people that make horror movies are pretty well balanced.
That's the thing. It was like you hear in the sporting world, it's a lot of fighters are very relaxed.
Yeah, yeah.
Because when you're making a movie like this, which is really intense and gory and all that, what's it like on set?
Fun. Like, truthfully, it's stressful because you're trying to stay on schedule. So, like, my life is a horror movie when I'm making a movie, but it's nothing to do with the content. It's just you have no life. It's really challenging. You're having to keep so many personalities all afloat at the same time. But it is a joy as well. Like, you wouldn't do it. You couldn't do it if you didn't love it. But on set, I tend to find, like, there's pressure around, especially I do a lot of practical and physical effects. So, yes, of course, I use CGI in places, but it's usually to knit things together. I always say I like to use CGI to not define something that I'm making, but to refine a moment. So we do a lot of practical stuff. So there's a lot of pressure around, is it going to be right? Sometimes it fails, sometimes it works. When you get a really cool physical special effect working on set that's required a relay of people working in different ways. And sometimes it's just the most simple of movie magic tricks.
Mm.
You know, you want someone to fall over at that time, they're pulled on a rope, then this thing appears. So a mat out of frame needs to get shoved in so they can hit the deck. And, you know, then there's a blast of air. All of that kind of magic trick work is really, really enjoyable, you know.
How do you balance being the writer and director?
Poorly. Yeah, it's tiring. You're doing three jobs when you're making a movie if you're writing and directing, because you're directing the film. But when you're making a movie, you're also prepping, you're building the train tracks in front of you. As prepped as you are, like we do on a movie like this, we did about 11, 12 weeks of what's called official prep, where the money's flowing, everybody's on board. People are joining the circus as we get closer. But essentially, if we were shooting a scene today where there's a massacre in a podcast room, we'd be set for this and we'd go and do it. And don't worry, that's not going to happen. I'm not packing a weapon. But let's say tomorrow it was going to be the cafe scene and someone's head's going to explode. There's people coming to me, show me photos and videos of the head that's going to explode tomorrow. And you're still giving feedback and prepping. So you're building the train tracks all the time. You're directing what's right in front of you. And then I'm rewriting in the evenings and the mornings just in terms of tweaking things along the way to running out of time with something, simplifying scenes, get a new idea, realize something doesn't work, pull back an old idea. So when you cross the line, like, you know, I look back at 2025 and I started work on the 5th of January on the movie. I had 2 weeks when we wrapped, and one of them was by accident because I'd shot so much material, my editor needed 2 weeks just to assemble it. I was only supposed to have a 1 week break and then I'd a week or so at Christmas, but that was it. So you just, it's very vocational in that way. You have to put your head down and just go at it.
I heard recently, being directed by Clint Eastwood is meant to be a pleasure because he doesn't shout action or cut. Because historically, he did a lot of Westerns and that would scare the horses.
Yeah.
So he would just say, whenever you're ready, and it would be very calm. What's your directing style?
I don't call action that frequently. I let my first assistant director do it. Unless there's a very particular reason. I'll call cut, obviously. Sometimes you use your vocals on a set to help create a mood as well. So, for example, let's say it was a really technical, complicated scene that everyone's tense about and there's loads of special effects. Like, I might be shouting cut as I'm running from my monitors back into the room to, you know, pat everybody on the back. And I might shout cut 20 times in a row. So people get a sense of the atmosphere. And you've got to, again, just bringing it back to, from a sporting analogy, like the psychology of a set is a really important thing. It's a very, very live group of people. You know, at camera alone, you could have 80 or 100 people working towards this close-up of the bottle. You know what I mean? And then you've all the backroom team as well.
How important is it to get the crew on side?
I think just any job, you have to treat people with respect. I don't try and get anybody on side. I think I just try and be really, really respectful for what people do. And also, one of the things, because there is, it's a business that is full of ego, and I've got my own, you know, and we all do in different ways. But one of the things I decided very early on, because I started out, first job in the business, I was a runner in Windmill Lane, post-production house, making coffee, changing the toilet rolls, running around town to get odd sandwiches and brown M&Ms for weirdos, you know, that kind of approach. And I decided that if I didn't know something, I'd just be really honest about it. I wouldn't try and cover it up. So every week on set, you know, it could be we're using a piece of equipment a certain way. And I'm like, I've never done this before. So educate me and then I can try and use it in the way that I want. And I think people that work on the technical side as crew really respect if you're kind of honest about that. It really helps as well.
Are you a perfectionist?
Totally. Not in life, but definitely on set. Yeah, definitely on set. But you have to let certain things slide. Because you can't perfect it, but the edit is where you can really start to
fight. Could you give me an example of something that you would let slide?
That I would let slide? Yeah. Oh, wow. Flyaway hairs. Because when you're shooting people and you're fixing hair, that can fly away hairs, you can get caught up in that stuff, but I can always digitally clean it up afterwards.
I heard Orson Welles talked about his biggest gift when he made Citizen Kane was ignorance, in that he didn't realise that a lot of the stuff wasn't actually possible at that time or perceived as doable, but it actually was, but no one had tried it.
I think you should always be dreaming I think the worst thing you can hear in filmmaking is, but that's how we always do it. Because it's an industry and a creative endeavour that's built on doing things that haven't been done before. Mm. So like, you know, someone's the first person that would have said, let's get 100 horses. Someone would have said, you can't do that. And sometimes it's to do with money, and I get that, but always trying to look for unique and different ways. And I've done it across all my movies where you've got an idea for something and you can't afford it or it doesn't work, and then you try and creatively find a way around that.
This is out now, of course, Lee Cronin is the Mummy. So a lot of people will know about this already. So the story, I guess a lot of, you know, movies that make an impact like this, it's often a simple enough story that it captures the imagination and beyond. But Jack Rayner plays the father.
Yes.
As part of a married couple. He's a journalist.
Yeah.
He's in Cairo. Their daughter gets abducted.
Correct.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Mummified. Years go by.
Yeah.
Daughter reemerges, but it's not the girl they once knew.
Except they don't know she's mummified yet. That's the trick in the movie. Which is she's been kidnapped, and we move forward 8 years and we meet this family who have never been able to close that void in their lives. And then there is a return. She's brought back. And the mystery is, why was she being kept inside? She's only been gone for 8 years. What's she doing in a 3,000-year-old sarcophagus? Why is she being kept there? But like any parents would, or anyone that loves anybody massively, if you lost any opportunity to bring somebody back into your life, they bring her home and they try and care for her, despite doubts and despite concerns. And she's brought something with her. And that's the secret and the trick of the movie.
I tell you why it's a difficult watch for me. As I've already expressed, the genre I have difficulty with generally. And then the idea of like losing your daughter is very real.
Yes. Yeah.
And but like all great movies, that's what challenges you.
It does. It does. And this movie strikes this balance of challenging you but also entertaining you.
Which is really important.
Which is a wild blend when you're dealing with, but no different a movie like Poltergeist back in the day. That's about a missing kid, missing inside her own home. They can hear her but they can't see her. And that's a little bit, this movie took a bit of influence from that because they get their loved one back. And you don't have to wait that long in the movie. She's home, but is she really home? And who is this person and what's wrong with her is kind of the thing that keeps the tension going. So quite a lot of psychology in the movie.
But it's really relatable to, even if you take it broader, just in real life of you were once very close to a person and then maybe that person changed a bit.
That changes.
You're wondering why.
That's one of the things in all of my movies, back to The Hole in the Ground, was always, it's a very frightening concept to look at somebody and then realize maybe they're not the person you thought they were anymore.
That's
scarier to
one
me.
One of the scariest things.
That's scarier to me than a vampire or whatever, you know, whatever might scare someone else, or a ghost coming around the corner. But I always bring it back to, it's like when you were younger, if you, or at any age, a new relationship, whether romantic or otherwise, and then you hear that person scream or something for the first time and you go, oh, I've never heard that noise. Who the hell are they? That scares me. People always go, what scares you? That scares me. That idea of being distant from somebody you recognise or love, because it can make you feel kind of lonely.
The changeling is a very prominent thing in Irish folklore.
Exactly. And in my first movie, The Hole in the Ground, is based on changeling mythology.
Would you recommend everyone of age to see this film?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's why you do it. I think my focus is on audience. I think it's definitely been created for you to go and have a really unique experience at the cinema. And it's a real collective experience. What I'd say is, if you're going to go and see it, bring a few people with you, because you'll talk about it afterwards. You'll probably need a pint.
I thought it was going to be, don't wear clothes where you can see the sweat pits.
Yeah,
afterwards.
One of the fun things about my movies is the last two, we've done our European premiere of the movie in Ireland. So we just did it last week. Yeah. And you know a bunch of people there. And you've got friends and you're like, God, I haven't seen you in a shirt with your hair done that nice in ages. 2 hours later, the hair's all over the shop. The shirt is open down to here. Yeah, which is, showing it to people you recognise when they're dolled up shows you the impact of the film.
There's such a great experience watching any movie is watching the film and then watching a loved one's reaction to
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
And it's horror is particularly special for that.
Yeah.
Because you do need that person with you.
It's great. And I had a row of all family and some friends at the screening the other day. So my dad is 84. He was a big horror fan as well. He was there the other day. And he's kind of unmovable. He just watches it and then he'll give me his analysis afterwards. But then watching some other people, a good friend of mine, Dan, his wife Elaine was there, and she was a bit uncomfortable. But it's fun. It's like eating spicy food. You know what I mean?
Everyone has a certain level of tolerance. Yeah.
Do you know, you're a Liverpool fan.
I am.
Yeah. So do you know the odd time you'll see a really horrific injury on the pitch, really gory, something happened to someone. Would that be very difficult for you to watch?
Yeah, like real world.
Yeah.
Like if I see someone throw a punch in the wild and connect with somebody, my stomach would turn.
Wow.
I hate violence. I was going to say, I hate violence with a passion. Might be part of why I present it on screen, but I've literally never thrown a punch in my life. Never been in a fight. Never been hit. I'd avoid it at all costs.
Where do you think it comes from? So your love of making this type of film?
I think probably, again, you know, those sort of fascinations with the things that terrify you, and a way to explore them is to actually go out there and present them artistically in some way. So again, we talked a little bit earlier on about this movie's about grief, but I'm not going to write about my experience in grief directly. Yeah. I'm going to write about something else about grief. I think it comes from a place of just trying to explore the things that give you anxiety.
A number to put on it would be 3 days, is it? Is that when a movie, you know it's made an impact when it stays with you for three days?
For 3 days, yeah.
Yeah.
And if I'm scared by something, it takes me 3 days to get over it usually.
So you're an adult watching Paranormal Activity, but you sleep with the light on after.
Done good research. That was the last movie that really scared me because, again, it cuts very close to the bone. Share a room with somebody, something weird is happening. Like, even, you all know, share a bed with somebody and they start to just talk in their dreams or their nightmares. You're literally, I'm reaching for the dagger at that point.
Did you have nightmares as a kid?
I still have nightmares all the time. After I watch a horror movie.
Yeah, so they would have been separate from watching horrors.
Yeah, I would have. I have a pretty active imagination, so I would, if I'm overtired, I'll dream like crazy. And even, I can't remember, sometimes I can remember them and write them down, but Freddy Krueger would pollute my dreams as a child for many, many years after I saw the Nightmare on Elm Street movies. He was always there.
So you were watching movies too young. Tarantino in his book talks about seeing movies that he shouldn't have seen.
Yeah.
My eldest is 14. Could I bring her? I mean, I know the...
Legally speaking?
Center.
I'm going to say, look, I'm the wrong person to answer that question because I saw a lot of horror movies when I was very young.
See, I'm inclined to, you know?
Yeah. It's a good way of talking about dark topics in our world.
Yeah.
And I think, again, like I saw Jaws was the one I saw at a really young age, Shining again before I was 10. My dad showed me Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2 before I was 10 years old.
I showed the under 10s Jaws. Everybody loved it.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. And Poltergeist is a great entry-level horror movie for young people as well. Yeah. There's a good bit of threat in it, but, you know, but it's a little bit magical as well.
You see, but we diverged, you and I, because I really relate to your sibling placement.
Okay.
My nearest sibling is 7 years older than me.
Gotcha.
And
so we're both accidents is what you're trying to say.
Oh, well, 100%. Yeah. I used to remind my dad of that regularly when he could have been retired.
Yeah.
Never had me. So there's two more way older. And then, the influence comes to them, like, pop culturally, is like the Ghetto Blasters and listening to their music through them.
Of course, yeah.
And then even being allowed to watch The X-Files. You know, stuff like that. But that was my entry. But you and I went separate ways with our...
What movies do you like then?
Every other genre I can stand.
Okay. Can you handle, though, like a really... Can you handle a really tense thriller?
Oh, yeah.
So it's not the tension that gets you?
No, I think...
You're scared of the boogeyman,
there's two things. I would flinch at the goriness, actually, which actually gets worse as I get older.
Mm-hmm.
And then, what's the other thing? Oh, yeah. I associate it with the cinema... Right? And I don't like jump scares because my popcorn will go everywhere.
That's fair, because you don't spill the popcorn.
And I'm waiting for it throughout the whole movie to be scared and I can't enjoy what's happening.
This movie isn't jump scare heavy. None of my movies... Of course, your horror movie, there's always a few jerkier moments, but it's not built on always going into the dark room, what's going to happen, the music stops, bang, something comes out. It's more of a psychological test than that.
No, but I become like obsessed with films. Like I will... If I like something, I will research it so much just for my own enjoyment of it. Like,
and do you have a favourite of all time?
Movie?
Yeah. Or up there on a given day?
I'd have All the President's Men.
Oh, I just rewatched it recently. It's so good.
It's just amazing. It's so the end of it is great. There's no music. There's nothing. It's working away tappy, and that's tappy, it. Tappy.
That's a movie I'd love to meet. You talked about whether is it all hard, like given the chance, a movie like that. Because it's tension, the thrills. Yeah. It's fantastic.
Moneyball?
My absolute comfort watch. Moneyball. And weirdly, The Big Short. You know, you connect me.
I love The Big Short.
The Big Short and Moneyball. If I have a hangover, that's happening.
I love Wall Street because I can't decide if Charlie Sheen's performance is good or not. And so I'll rewatch it. And I think Michael Douglas is amazing. He won the Oscar for that.
Yeah.
And his speech was a big F you to everyone who said that he could do it because he was a producer.
Yeah.
Not known as a producer. And,
haven't seen that in a long time.
Midnight Run.
Haven't seen that in a long time.
Is one of my favourite. De Niro and... Charles Grodin.
Charles Grodin.
Who De Niro had to fight for to get the position because they wanted... It was Cher was supposed to be in it with him.
Really?
And then Robin Williams. And then, so it was Grodin's biggest role, I think. And he passed away a few years ago.
I watched Tombstone the other night. I'd actually never seen... I thought I'd watched it.
Yeah.
And I hadn't. I watched Tombstone the other night, which is a pretty wild, wild ride. Val Kilmer's amazing. Have you seen Tombstone?
Yeah, when it came out originally.
Yeah. I've recently watched Heat a few times, having... Watched it throughout the years and never really appreciated until very recently. And Val Kilmer is just incredible in it.
That's amazing you bring that up because, again, buddy of mine is a big Michael Mann fan.
Yep.
And I've seen Heat once and it just didn't connect. And I actually downloaded it for a long-haul flight there recently. And I went, no, everyone says how good this is. I'm not going to watch it on my iPad. I'll watch it at home on a bigger screen. So it's funny you bring up Heat because it's firmly on my list to revisit because I feel like I've missed something.
I was the same. I usually tune out of action scenes, generally speaking. Like DC Marvel, I would like struggle to pay attention sure. with it, but I appreciate what it is. But I thought that would heat, and then I watched it again and was like, oh, it's actually not about the action at all.
Yeah.
It's about relationships with people. Mm-hmm. I love dialogue, basically.
You like a good dialogue movie.
I like dialogue. You'd be, don't tell me now, Ger, your movie that you love the most is, what's it, River Phoenix, Stand By Me.
Oh, well, that's for one that you share with your kids. Chinatown's my favourite.
Oh, Chinatown's incredible. Jack Nicholson in that era.
So, so good.
Rewatched Network recently again.
Oh, Network's another one of my top 10.
Network is one that, I saw younger. I rewatched it a couple of years ago and I didn't like it.
Oh, all right.
I don't know why. I don't know.
Do you not think it's aged well? Or
I don't know what it was. Could have been a mood thing. It just didn't hit for me the way, and everyone always talks about how great it is, and it didn't connect for me.
I watched that, and I'd watched Chinatown, and then I watched what's the Steve McQueen, Faye Dunaway,
Getaway,
the one they remade. No, the one that they remade with Pierce Brosnan.
I was going to say Thomas Crown Affair.
Yeah, it is. It is. She had a.
Which is getting remade again right now.
Is it?
It is.
She had quite the run, Faye Dunaway.
Faye Dunaway. Yeah. She's unbelievable in that movie, in Network. And Peter Finch won the Oscar for that, for Network.
But
had died before he could collect it. So he was the first to do that.
What year was that? Was that like
mid-70s for sure. Mid-76. And the next person to achieve that honour and to have passed away before he collected was Heath Ledger.
Heath Ledger.
Yeah.
What a performance that was. One last one.
Yeah, go ahead.
Can you handle a psychological art? Like, could you watch Rosemary's Baby? And if you haven't, you should.
What, remind me again, what's that about?
It's about a...
The devil is... It's the devil.
See, that thing, is it the devil thing that's going to freak you out?
No, but just remind me, because I think I've watched it.
Sissy Spacek.
Mia Farrow, John Cassavetes, they move into a new, beautiful kind of apartment. Building. She gets pregnant. Devilish cult next door involved with the pregnancy. And if you haven't, you should go back and watch. Or The Wicker Man. Not the Nicolas Cage one. Go back and watch The Wicker Man. And they're both of those movies I connect. They're really terrifying because it's about central character and everybody else is lying.
I tell you a movie that really stuck with me. The 3-day rule that you have, right? I don't even know if I liked it, but it stuck with me. 1408, Room 1408. I think it largely got...
John Cusack about.
I think that's a great premise for... I mean,
it was
really, about the
really
hotel
good.
Room in The Shining.
Yeah,
it was. This is all about that room, and no one can handle it. That was amazing. That really, I enjoyed that.
Another one I happened to watch not that long ago. And there's a weird connection between that movie and my movie, which is both feature the song "The Weight" by the band. And what happened was I had the song in the cut, and the estate said no, they didn't want it to be in a horror movie. But then I found out it was in 1408.
Yeah.
So there was a letter crafted. And they gave us the rights.
Oh, wow.
They gave us the rights as if it's free.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
had to cut a massive check, but yeah.
You have your own production company, Wicked Good.
Yes.
Actually, ask a very simple question. I've always wondered about this. It's like, what's it like to have your own production company? Is that a real full-time job in itself? Does it work around you, if you get me?
We have a great, it's a great team. So I have my business partners and producers, John Kevill and McDara Kelleher. So they're the ones keeping... It's not even the day-to-day because we've got a great back office of wonderful people that work as well. But it's really there. Like, when I'm busy making a movie, there's very little I can do for my own production company because it's all-consuming, except reading other screenplays in the background, because it's not about my projects. It's about the projects we're trying to build with lots of different talent and big movies we want to make in Ireland and all of that sort of stuff. So it's relatively new. It was always on the agenda. Like, I had production companies when I was younger, different little entities to do jobs and do things. But this one, we work with, we've what's called a first look deal in the industry with Warner Brothers. So anything that I generate or anything that I like for somebody else to work on, Warner Brothers look at it first and then they can pass or they can kind of go along with it. So we're kind of in cooperation with them at the moment. It's exciting actually because there's even a couple of scripts I've written, and maybe in terms of my own ambition, I've just gone past them in the visual scale of what I could achieve with them.
Yeah.
Then trying to find up and coming filmmakers that can step in, and then you step back and you become a producer on that is actually a really exciting thing as well.
McDowell's dad, of course, was the film censor. I could ask him
indeed.
If I could let my 14-year-old into watch this.
He was indeed. And he was at the screening last week and he enjoyed it. So, yeah. But it is an 18s, which seemed to surprise everybody.
Oh, yeah.
So was my last movie.
There you go.
nothing greater than the badge of honour of having an 18s film. It reminds me of being a kid and seeing RoboCop on the shelf and being like, big red dot, I want that.
Yeah,
that's what I want to watch.
Absolutely. You talked about movies being passed on. Did the love of Liverpool get passed on?
No, not at all.
All right.
Very, very simple story. So, who do you guys support?
I'm an Aston Villa fan.
United.
You're United. I knew you were a United fan. I wasn't sure who you supported. So, Italia 90, like so many of us of my generation, got drawn in at that point. First thing I ever recorded off the television on a VHS tape was Ireland versus England at Italia 90, and watched that to death. Still have that tape somewhere, Kevin Sheedy scoring, which is what, about the 77th minute, I'm going to say. It was pretty late on. But basically, obsessed with football. First time I felt a sense of national pride and identity, what being from somewhere meant.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was 7 or 8 years old. And then at the end of that summer, my cousin, who was a couple of years older than me, big into football, had the pullout from Shoot magazine, which obviously had, one side was the Liverpool squad, the other side was the Man United squad. And I was like, he was telling me there's this whole thing, there's the league, and I knew nothing about football.
Mm.
There's this, all of this world. And he goes, I'll give you this poster. He was a Man United fan. And I took one look at them and said, they look like a bunch of pricks. And I stuck, I stuck the Liverpool side up, and that was it. And I'm obsessive. That was it. There was no other discussions. There was no other friends, no family. Like, one of my brothers, he's a Man United fan, as in, like so many that are fair weather and they're successful. He's a Man United fan, but the rest of the time he's not interested. There was no, my dad is not a sports guy. My mum absolutely loved rugby, like obsessive with rugby. My sister, no particular interest. So huh. It was just me and a massive obsession. Even when I'm traveling for work in different time zones, I'll get up at all hours and reschedule meetings to watch matches.
So when your dad rented The Shining and was watching it and you could hear it upstairs.
Yeah.
And you were fearful all over again.
Yeah.
Would you have had the Liverpool posters all around you at this point?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, well, no, let me think.
About 8 then, were you?
Yeah, it was in and around that time. It might have been a touch before. I couldn't pinpoint it exactly.
Were you sporty yourself?
I played football for Skerry's Town. Yeah.
Good team?
I was always on the B team, and then we actually got promoted above the A team, which caused a lot of
problems. Controversial.
Yeah, very controversial. But the usual thing as well, of like, because my parents weren't into it, there was always that, you know, the dad, and I get it, the dads that were involved more and all that stuff, that was the A team, and then we were kind of the rogue kind of bunch.
Were you a winger?
No, I started left back, right back, and a very lazy Jan Mulby-esque centre midfielder.
Brilliant. Oh, nice. Were you left footer?
I could play both feet.
Oh,
yeah, I had decent passing range. And that was about it. But I can still, I can still remember the first goal I ever scored under nines, away in St. Anne's Park against, can't remember right now who it was against, because a few different teams would play out there. But I can remember this little tap in that I scored. And the dad of one of the other guys I played on the team ran a paper and paint shop in Skerry's and had these Bart Simpson football t-shirts and gave me one afterwards.
Wow. Like, that was your reward.
That was it was just like, and we won 1-0 as well. It was the last minute. It was the last minute.
Class. Let's get to your first choice here. Liverpool won Wolves 0.
Yeah.
From March 2004, a late Sammy Hupia goal gives Liverpool a fortuitous win over Wolves, says the BBC Football website.
Very memorable.
Yeah. Like a lot of what that era was. It was the end of the Hulier era.
That's right.
It was very close to the end, because he would have been gone at that the summer. Top of the next season. Yeah.
Yeah, Rafa Benitez.
So it was the end of the Hulier era. It was my first trip. An ex-girlfriend of mine, her dad ran the Liverpool Supporters Club out in the Balbriggan area. And so first tickets, so excited. But one of the things that stuck out, got the tickets and they said restricted view on them. We were in the main stand before they'd redone it, which used to have some poles. Not that it got in the way, but you know, that level of excitement for something. Because I'd been to a bunch of Ireland matches here and I'd been to a bunch of rugby matches here as well, but I'd actually never, you know, I was at a basic 20 before I went away to a game or whatever,
yeah.
20, 21. And we were god awful. But I was towards the cop end of of the main stand, and Hupia scored in, I guess it was in the 92nd minute or something like that. It was right to the death. It was something we're particularly good at and did only the other day as well.
In their DNA,
in our DNA. It's funny, growing up, I always thought it was United that were the last minute kings because they won so much off the back of later victories under Ferguson.
Yeah.
But it's only recently I realised how much Liverpool have done in the Premier League era.
93rd minute.
Yeah. But it was a towering header. And it was glorious. And then the next game I went to, we got beaten 4-1 by Chelsea. I remember Daniel Agger gave away a penalty. Oh, I feel like that was the next
that's
year.
A few years, is it? Later.
I think it was maybe the next year or maybe 2 years later. And I don't think Drogba scored, but he just ran the show.
Oh, yeah.
And I was sitting right by the Chelsea fans. So the other end of the main stand, and it was horrific.
Just the Liverpool team this day.
That wouldn't put you off going back then, the 4-1. It's like one of those jarring experiences. You're like, oh, I'm not doing
this. But
the
worst part was also I'd booked the museum and the tour for the next day, which has happened to me before, and I've gone to defeats. Mm. And then you, for whatever reason, you're like, I don't really want to be involved with football the day after.
This is a real throwback because Jamie Carragher's playing fullback at this point. In this game, you're at the Wolves game.
It was way, way back.
Dudek's and goal, Hoopy and Bishkan, centre half, Risa.
Bishkan at centre half.
Right? Yeah. Okay. Danny Murphy. Do you know who comes on for Danny Murphy? Florence Cinema Pangole. Oh, remember him?
Yeah. He was bought with Anthony Letelec.
That's right.
They were bought at the same time.
Diddy Haman, Stevie G, Harry Kewell. What could have been?
So not that long later, I went to see Liverpool Man City before they had the influx of money, and Harry Kewell scored a 1-0, and I put a bet on him in the stadium. Like, I'd put like 20 quid on. He was 7-1 for first goal, and Joey Barton got sent off the same day.
But winner chicken dinner.
Yeah. But another trip to Anfield for an awkward 1-0 win.
Heskey and Michael Owen up front just weeks before he went to Real Madrid.
Wow.
Yeah. For Wolves, Paul Ince was playing, one of your old players.
And one of your old players as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Loved Ince.
Yeah. They're kind of underappreciated by both United and Liverpool.
I think so, yeah.
Because he played for both of them.
Precisely. But it still didn't get his due as a player. Roy Keane often talks about how underrated Paul Ince is in the grand scheme.
I remember being delighted when Liverpool signed him because I was going, we're signing like a proven winner here.
Alex Higgins, talk about him all day, couldn't you?
Yeah, so from Skerries, as we talked about, and at the time, so snooker for me was something I'd watch late at night with an old auntie of mine when she'd come and stay. She'd stay up drinking sherry and watch snooker till like the wee hours and watch like reruns and stuff like that. So I always had a decent interest, and especially that era, like, you know, late 80s into the 90s, when there was still some actual, you know, it just had a bit more presence, almost the way darts does now, the way people really connect with the characters in, as much as anything. And, so basically living in Skerries, and it was my first ever girlfriend, like 16 or 17. And obviously been staying up late watching movies or something. And she lived across the road from a pub called the Gladstone in Skerries, which still runs. Great pub. If you're ever in Skerries, go in. Cash only, just heads up. but it's really, really great, really, really great pub. And back then they had a full-size snooker table in the lounge. And I'd heard that Alex Higgins was going down there and would play people for a tenner.
Right.
You paid a tenner. And I guess it was probably, it would have been pre the Euro, so it was £10. And he'd play in a frame of snooker. And you always wonder, was it true or not? I think I'd heard that he did this in a few different pubs in a few different places. And then one night, about 12:30 or 1 o'clock in the morning, it's about a 10-minute walk back to my house, walk out the front door of my girlfriend at the time's house, and there's this figure kind of standing in the door. The pub was literally just across this street, not even a wide street. And he comes walking out. It was like the rain from Road to Perdition or something. It wasn't windy, just this, and I feel like it was summertime, just this rain falling, streetlights. And I'm like, I think that's Alex Higgins. And he walked over to me, and he was pretty ill at the time.
Yeah.
He was really, really thin. And we just had this 10-minute conversation. He'd had a few drinks, I guess, but didn't seem inebriated in any way. But I wish I could remember all of the details, but he was like, he was really reflecting on his life.
Wow.
He wanted to just talk to a stranger.
Wow.
And he was looking up at the sky, and I remember looking up, and his neck was really thin. And
he had awful mouth.
I can't remember specifically, but he'd had cancer in that area, and he was looking up at the sky, and he was almost like he was letting himself be baptized. I remember that just was felt like a strange, I don't say religious experience at all, because it wasn't for him, he just met me on the street. But it was just a very, I remember walking up the road, he talked for about 10 minutes and he touched just a bit on his life and success and victory. Mm. But it was all these little staccato moments. It wasn't necessarily like a, let me tell you a story, young lad. It was just these like sparks of thoughts in his head. And it's one of those things that like sometimes I go, did that really happen? You know what I mean? But I remember walking up the road in the rain really slowly and just being like, that was just a really amazing but bizarre encounter. You're like, you're looking at an absolute world champion.
Do you ever write stuff like that as a result of things? And I don't mean like I met this person who was like a superstar, but that bit where he can tell the tableau of his life with snatches. Maybe you fill in the blanks because you're familiar with the backstory.
Yeah.
But does it ever influence your writing? Like,
I think leaving information out is a really important part of writing, because otherwise you're kind of just giving people an instruction manual. And that's something that I think is really important. Something in this movie that I just made was a real challenge. There's a big, broad story that takes place over 3,000 years. And you could say there's rules and there's, but I'm only going to give you just about enough information. Not everybody loves that, but I like it.
How did you go about hiring Egyptian actors and get the Arabic language into The Mummy? Was that a lot of work?
Yeah, well, you've got, again, it's the team you have. So really great casting directors. And what I, it's, people can only work to the brief you provide. So I'll say a big part of being a director, people go, what's your job? Like, it must be glamorous. It must be that. No, I'm a filter. People ask me questions. I give answers. And I've got a blurry picture on the wall that I'm looking at. I've got a vision for something. And, you know, literally, do you want red or do you want green? And you're like, I want green because. And do you want, like, when it comes to cast, one of the, well, what are you looking for? And I said, authenticity. So that becomes part of the brief. I want authenticity. And I want people that, it was really important that they could speak Arabic in the correct way so that there was this grounded quality to the movie.
Sorry, that bit about filling in all the information. Recently, there was that interview that Ben Affleck...
Oh, the Netflix one. Yeah.
Is that a real thing for you as you go forward? That, like...
Yeah, it's
there's going to be people on their phone watching this fucking movie. That's bullshit. Like, and yet I accept that that might be the case.
We've all done it. I'm not going to pretend there's not something you put on. Like, not if it's a movie that I, you know... To be honest, for me, it's your loss. If you don't pay attention to something, you've got the power to rewind. But the things that I make, I'm as best I can, I'm focused on the theatrical experience, that collective gathering of people. And it's really exciting. Like, for me, even just over the weekend, I came back to Ireland. I'd been in the US promoting the movie. And my previous movie, I stayed in the US in LA. Opening weekend for a movie when you're in Los Angeles is a mad experience because you go screen hopping and you see people queuing up and you hear information that this is sold out. So I'd worked very hard in this. I just needed to detach and kind of chill out a little bit. But I was still just getting reports from people of full house here, full house there, which is what draws me to it. That's not to say I have a couple of TV shows at my company. The small screen, I got most of my film education from the small screen at home, rewinding and fast forward and watching stuff over and over again. But I do think that collective experience is important.
Yeah. And we should fight to protect it.
We should absolutely fight to protect it, you know, because there's not a lot of reasons sport bring us together. Going to watch a movie brings us together. People that want to practice religion brings them together in a collective place. I'm not a religious person, but you know what? Sometimes you go, when you were younger, it was nice on a Sunday all going into one big room together.
Well, yeah.
And catching up and talking. And we can get very isolated by our interactivity with the device in our pocket.
Totally. Know? Like outside of a match or maybe a concert, it's a great collective experience. I remember going to a packed Douglas Cinema in Cork watching Team America.
Amazing. And well, the
atmosphere was, it was honestly electric.
Yeah. Yeah.
Electric.
A really good comedy. And that's one of the things, as people have start consuming comedy at home so much, there's less comedy films working in the cinema.
Why is that happening? Why is the Judd Apatow era?
I think it always comes in waves. I think people just don't go out for it. That's, if people went out for it, more would get made.
It's not like an increasingly humorous world, is it? Because it's so tragic what's happening.
It's like the way I was watching, said I watched Tombstone the other day and then I was thinking about Dances with Wolves with Kevin Costner or something like that.
Mad cues.
Yeah, but if you made that now, no one would go to the cinema to watch it.
No, it's too long.
It's too long. Yeah. Or even if it's not the length, it's like there's just, like, so it's interesting at the moment, you're seeing it, it's been bubbling for a while, kind of slightly steamy, you know, that movie The Housemaid, like those things are coming back. 5 years ago, if you tried to pitch, we're gonna make a movie like Basic Instinct and put it in the cinema, no one would be interested. I think it's getting remade now.
So a bit like sport, it is cyclical, the type of movies. There's no movie that's died out completely, is there?
I don't think so. Like, even if you look, I know this is TV, but if you look at Stranger Things, loads of people would have pitched Spielbergian-style shows with horror and this, and it just wouldn't have taken off. And then something will click and connect. And usually that's just a really good story, really good characters. You
one
know?
Of my favourite films ever, because it is taken seriously within the film, but it's just so much fun, is Point Break.
Really good.
I just watch Point Break endlessly.
With the Chili Peppers in it.
With Anthony Kiedis. Yeah, getting shot in the foot.
Yeah.
And
is Flea in it as well?
No, Flea's in My Own Private Idaho.
Okay, yeah.
With Keanu Reeves and River Phoenix.
Yeah.
Which is very good.
Yeah, yeah.
But the Point Break, the ending to Point Break, is one of my favourite ending scenes ever. Because it's so absurd what he does.
Catherine Bigelow, great director as well.
And it is great. She was married to...
James Cameron.
James Cameron,
yeah.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
And then...
I know, were they married?
I get confused
because Gaylan Hurd and James Cameron, who was his producer, was married. I get confused sometimes.
Maybe they were going
it's
out.
It's Hollywood, though. Talk about cyclical. There's like loads of...
Yeah, well, sorry, is Hollywood as crazy as it seems in your experience?
I think, sadly not anymore. I talk to my manager about this a lot and we feel like
You missed out on the head.
I feel like we
there was a hedonistic peak. Exactly. That was no longer.
I feel like there is aspects of it that are very entertaining, and it's got a lot of charm when you dig back into some of the old stuff. Like, there's a really famous restaurant just off Hollywood Boulevard called Musso and Frank's. It's the oldest spot. You know what I mean? That still exists, but. One of the actors in my movie, Mexican actor called Veronica Falcone, knows the manager really well. My family came over to the US for the premiere. My siblings and a couple of my nieces. And it was like really exciting. So like, I want them to have this Hollywood experience. So Veronica arranged, we had like the Rolling Stones booth in Musso and Frank's. And you know, the food is fine, but it doesn't matter. You get the steak, you get the cream spinach, you get the martini with the sidecar. And, you know, and then someone will go, that's where Marilyn Monroe used to sit. And like, there is that sort of history. Although it's a recent history, it's really nice. It is really, really nice. But in terms of the day-to-day, I think one of the tricky things sometimes people forget about Hollywood or Los Angeles is it's a really blue-collar town. Like, and what drives the industry is lots and lots of people
going,
working extremely hard, like within the industry. And like one of the things at the moment, not something I've talked about a lot, but would be like the amalgamation of studios, Paramount taking over Warner Brothers, for example. People will lose their jobs, and that's not a good thing at all. Because those people are what make the place what it is.
One studio less making movies.
Exactly. Yeah, because I went on a Humphrey Bogart.
That's a deep dive.
Yeah, deep dive recently. I was watching The African Queen. Did you ever see that?
I would have when I was younger on TV. That's the boat.
Yeah, and it's in colour, which is unusual to see Bogart in colour. And I just wanted to see what the fuss with this guy was. He's amazing. Like, he doesn't have quintessential leading man looks or anything like that, but there's something about him. But I was like, well, that's the golden age of Hollywood around then. But then you listen to the stories about that movie, and it was just all work. They all got sick because it was filmed over there.
Yeah.
And the only two who didn't was Humphrey Bogart himself and the director who's in Chinatown, who's...
John Huston.
He died in Galway, didn't he? Big Irish connection.
He did, yeah. I think the Galway, the film school there is called the Huston School of Film and Media.
Great story of that is that they all died drinking the water, except for Humphrey Bogart and John Huston, because all they drank was whiskey.
Perfect.
So they were the only ones that didn't get sick. Oh, that's a great old story, right? And I was like, well, does that actually happen anymore and all that? And then even like a movie like, say, True Romance, which is another favourite of mine.
What a movie.
My wife walked down to You're So Cool by Hans Zimmer, The Wedding.
Really?
Because it's a great tune. And
that's incredible.
And that ensemble cast of all the greats, like Brad Pitt taking this tiny role and owning it, and James Gandolfini. And that scene between Christopher Walken and...
Dennis Hopper.
Yeah. And it was like all these greats working together, and you have this romantic notion of what it would have been like when the director shouts cut. Mm-hmm. But it's probably extremely workmanlike.
Of course, yeah. And there are moments that are... If there's a really cool documentary, if you ever want to see a little bit of insight into like modern, that era, like the Tarantino kind of cool, is there's a documentary called Full Tilt Boogie, which is about the making of From Dusk Till Dawn. And it's pretty gonzo style. It's just a few people with camcorders just capturing the indie spirit of making that movie. And there is moments that are just our work. I mean, like, people want to go home and people have different pressures and different things kind of going on. But there are moments where it is also, it can be really, really fun. And I don't know if the cool sense is too obvious a word, but it can be really fulfilling.
Yeah. Let's get back to your list here, because we have an American football entry, which Ger will like particularly.
Well, I'm a 49ers fan.
There you go.
And these two teams obviously have had very great success recently.
So yeah. I'm not going to pretend. I've always had a passing interest. Again, a good friend of mine, Dan, who I brought up, he played football through into college in the US to like a reasonable-ish level. So he claims. I haven't seen any highlights. but he will talk about it and kind of stoked my interest a little bit. But just at the end of last year, I was over for work. I was finishing a bunch of the movie over in LA, and a colleague of mine, friend over there, a guy called Owen Egan, who's from Limerick and lives over there, and he's well connected, and he was like, "Do you want to go to Rams Seahawks?" But it was the full package. It was like the best suite you could imagine in the house. And I'd been out the night before, and when I'm busy working, it takes 3 drinks and I'll have a hangover the next day. So I'd had about 3 or 4 drinks the night before, because I think the game was a Sunday on the Saturday, and I felt pretty wrecked and got in at the Jumbotron and the level of lights in that stadium. I've never seen anything like it.
People talk about the stadium as being like a truly remarkable experience.
That was insane. We stopped off and had a gawk at like everyone tailgating beforehand, because my previous American sporting experience had been very minimal. I'd been to an Islanders game in ice hockey in 2019, which was fun. I think they won that day. That was with my buddy Dan, who's from Long Island. He lives here and he's a Liverpool fan, passionate, passionate Liverpool fan. He was over there and I was over there at the same time, went to an Islanders game. And then it wasn't until that, just before the football game, I went to one of the World Series.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And it was the one where the Blue Jays got two home runs right away and we were stuck in the parking lot. So I missed the best part of it. And it was a really, really flat match, but had the Dodger dog and the beer that's bigger than your head. And, you know, it was pretty fun. But what I do find interesting, and it's not a criticism, but watching American sports live is because there's a lot of, there can be stoppages, as we all know. And so to re-engage, they tell you when to celebrate, what to do. It's constantly telling you, cheer now, stamp your feet, do this, do that. So there's no natural ebb and flow that I could identify to, you know yourself, you're watching a football game, it's like it's flat. Even nowadays with VAR, it could be like a VAR decision suddenly ignites the crowd or whatever.
And you're all about authenticity.
And I loved it for what it is. And I'd go back in a heartbeat. Mm. Mainly the food was lovely and the drinks were lovely.
Yeah, it's good though.
But it was. I almost felt like I was going to leave with a suntan. The Jumbotron was just kind of amazing. Yeah. But Dodger Stadium, I'd recommend a visit to because it's kind of set a little bit out of town. The sun was going down. It's kind of, you slightly go down into it.
Yeah.
Kind of underground, you know, and you've got that California vibe. I get the, first time I've ever been to a baseball game, love a baseball movie, like Field of Dreams, you know what I mean? Or
Moneyball.
There's so many great movies like that. So the romance of baseball to me as a sport is really interesting. Mm. And also, it's one of those ones where people will sometimes be put off as if it's complicated. It's actually really, really
simple. It's rounder when you're a kid. It's just
really simple. The
strike zone is imaginary. Now, at least then, when you watch it on TV, they're like, if the ball is in here, it's essentially.
Yeah.
We're recording an hour now, so we better wrap up these last two. We're back to football. No, that's all not. So, Phil Babb, this is interesting. This is what I love about the evolution of You Had To Be There, which is running for 4 years now, this series.
Yeah, yeah.
And it actually started off as a player playing it in a match. This is just meeting Phil Babb.
So there was a Phil Babb obsession because what year can anyone remember what year he signed? Was it 90? Would it be 94 or something like that?
Well, it's after the World Cup, isn't it? He's still a competent player.
Yeah, it was 95. Yeah, it would have been. Was it a mid-season sign? I can't even remember the details. I think it was a summer signing.
Phil Babb signed in 1994 from Coventry.
So after the World Cup, because that's a good summer to be Phil Babb.
Yes, exactly. So come out of the World, there was the links, and it was back in the day where you got your transfer information from Teletext.
Oh, I loved this.
And because I remember the Heskey signing. I remember seeing that 8.5 million. I think that was what Heskey was
signing. Which is a lot of money.
Was a lot of money, yeah. And but basically, when the Babb signing was completed, I was in the UK having a little family holiday. My uncle worked for the Mirror newspaper in Canary Wharf, and I happened to be in the office when they were piecing the story together that news had broken. So I got this slight jump. And everyone knew it was going to happen, but the slight jump. There was a photo editor working, and I was placing the Phil Babb picture. So like this Irish guy, centre back for Liverpool. I'm obsessed. Still not that long into the drought that you didn't feel like imminent massive success was around the corner.
Yeah.
And on that trip, I managed to, through various begging off different relatives, cobble together the money in different pieces to buy. Do you remember that gold kit that Liverpool had, the famous gold kit? So I got the jersey, then the shorts, then eventually the socks, and got back home, and I'd never had a player's name on the back of a jersey at all. So I was like, this is the one. Hadn't had the opportunity. Didn't have a load of football jerseys, you know, that some odd ones. And I remember like the Italia 90 USA jersey because it was for sale for like £5 in my local sports shop. And I still have them.
But they're cool.
I'm an awful hoarder. But I got back and said to my big brother, he was going into town, want you to go and get Babb 6 on the jersey. Really excited. Hadn't I, you know, the Premier League letters. Pressed and all of that stuff. My brother likes to wind me up, so he was going into town and he left a note and said, hey Lee, gone to get Babb, but he left one B off. He's got a B-A-B. So gone to get Babb 6. No mobile phone. So I'm a whole day of just like, oh my God, he's got it wrong. Came back, I'm sure, he goes, don't worry, mate. He goes, I wouldn't have done that. I was just winding you up. So big relief. Then crestfallen, he hadn't gone to Arnott's to get the proper letters. He'd gone to like a t-shirt
and had
this bubble writing that said Babb 6 on the back. I was like,
and top floor of Stephen's Green.
Yeah, exactly. It was it was just like not the right. Especially everyone around me was a United fan. Everyone there with the big block, like, you know, Pallister across the back and the Premier League logos, and I've got this fucking cartoon writing on the back of my Bab jersey. It was awful.
Did you wear it in the end?
I did. I wasn't wearing it when I met Phil Babb, but that was due to, you know, the hanging around at the airport hotel.
Oh yeah, yeah.
To meet the players, and he'd just signed, or maybe it was the year when did Liverpool win the Coca-Cola Cup? It was
95.
So, okay, Bab was already signed and had played, because there's a piece of video of me just saying as many words as I could at Phil Babb. Phil Babb, you're the best, you're this, you're that, Coca-Cola Cup winners, etc. Wild. And then I was actually at a Liverpool game, Liverpool-Brentford, at the start of last season, and I had the tickets beforehand where you get the dinner, and Phil Babb was the guest the speech. And I did have a bad hangover, so I didn't want to do the food, and I was hanging around by the bar, and I was talking to one of the guys that runs it, like, that works for Liverpool, and I was like, I told him a bit of the Phil Babb story, and he goes, I'll bring you over to introduce you. And then this kid distracted Phil Babb, and I never got the chance to talk.
That's tough.
So then, like, another 9-year-old was like, Phil Babb. So yeah, that's the Phil Babb one.
He'll come to the premiere of your next movie, I'm sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
If you're out there, Phil, please.
Who's your favourite Liverpool player?
Of all time?
Yeah.
Oh, I really struggle with this one. I really, really do struggle with this one.
He's before your time, really, but have you seen the Dalglish documentary?
Yeah, it was amazing. It was really amazing.
I'm not a Liverpool fan, but as I watched that, I was like, he's my favourite.
It sure got me onto that, and neither of us Liverpool supporters.
It is, and it's, you know, it's beautiful about it. It's just a presentation of information, because the director has made things like Senna, you know, and these complicated documents.
It shouldn't even be interesting, because it's just about success after success.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it's there's incredible. Hillsborough he deals with. But that's Azif Kapadia, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
We had him in your very seat, actually.
Amazing, yeah.
Talking incredible. About the Diego Maradona documentary you did a few years ago.
Incredible documentary maker. Really, really.
Are you able to enjoy watching things? Just
I watch a lot of documentaries when I'm making movies.
Oh.
So I struggle to watch new movies when I'm watching movies. I can watch classics that I know really well, or documentaries. But now that I'm between films, I'll go on a bit of a run.
It's like us watching a game when we're not working. Can you totally
separate yourself? You see the joins all the time.
Yeah.
It is hard to switch off the analytical mind, for sure.
Last one, Euro 2012. We had so much hope in this game. The first one, Ireland against Croatia. Yeah. 1-1, Sean St. Ledger, 19th minute equaliser.
Yes.
And then disaster happens.
Yeah, and it was an absolutely disastrous day for me, full stop.
Oh, really?
But anyone that went to Euro 2012 will know, everyone had one individual day that was an existential crisis of the greatest amount due to the level of partying that took place. We went up there about 4 days. Mine happened to be match day one, where I was absolutely dying. I found a little pocket of forest near the stadium in Poznan. I had to like lie down and just was literally like, I'm the one that had sourced all the tickets for all my friends piece by piece each game on that portal that you had
a lot of responsibility.
Yeah, it was, but we had it sorted out. And there I am lying on the ground going, I just think I want my mother at this point. Send the mammy copter to bring me home. I'm like, I'm over it all. But it passed. And look, the whole reason to bring up Euro 2012 was that I've been a football fan since 1990. Didn't get to go to USA 94 because parents weren't into football. Too young to go my own. Not too young, but didn't get out to Japan 2002. And then it was such a long wait. And it was that goal from St. Ledger. Just suddenly, for that brief moment, you thought, it's all going to happen. But man, that group was insanity.
The other two teams were amazing, and the Croatian side were unbelievably insane.
That was the final, wasn't it? The next two games were the finalists.
Yeah, correct. But I think
Italy.
For me, it was getting to first-hand experience that Irish contingent abroad. And I remember we got into Poznan, and I was still a bit tipsy from the night before. The kind of that, you know, sometimes if you're a bit hungover, you've got that moment where the switch just flicks and you go, oh no, I think I'm sobering up. But anyway, it was a mess. But I was still happy enough, hit the square in Poznan. And just to see it, like the flags and everything, that linked back to that sense of national pride and identity in 1990.
And this was your slice of it.
This was our slice of it, albeit we got hockeyed and kicked all around the place. But yeah, and we also stayed really far away from the epicenter. So after that game, we had a 3-hour train ride back to where we were staying. And after the Spain hammering, we had a 5-hour from Gdansk back. So like we earned our pain.
Yeah, you were a busy man at that time. You were steep in your short film career. I think you had done three at that point.
I would have been directing TV commercials at the time as well. Yeah, okay. So, but it was a great trip. And just like I remember we stayed in it was in Poznan. The mayor of Poznan did a thank you and put this photo thing up in St. Stephen's Green.
Oh yeah, all these photographs. Yeah.
And we ended up being in one of them. Randomly, one of our mates was dressed up as the Honey Monster, full in that heat. I have a great photograph of him, and he'd put the white away jersey with the Richard Dunn 6 drawn on the back in the full Honey Monster. And we have a great picture of him and a bunch of Polish nuns. That's one of my favourite pictures from that trip. But yeah, it was disastrous for football, but spectacular from having the experience he'd always dreamed about having.
Lee Cronin's The Mummy is out now. It's one of the top 5 movies in the world. And Lee Cronin himself, that was a fantastic. You had to be there.
Thanks so much, guys. Pleasure.
You had to be there.
Off the Ball Breakfast.
With Viagra Connect 50mg film-coated tablets. Contains sildenafil for adult men with erectile dysfunction. Maximum dosage 150mg tablet per day. Always read the label. Buy online at viagraconnect.ie. Subject to suitability following pharmacist consultation.
On Off the Ball.
Once the fallibility centre sets in, once age starts to catch up with him, once Stephen Hendry's there, Steve Davis rolling back the years is one of the great things in snooker. Just because he was old and, as you know, to use John's phrase, had exposed his feet of clay.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.